Recording has started.
All right, thank you. Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the IGO, INGO Access to Curative Rights Protection Mechanisms Working Call, held on the 5th of October, 2017. On the call today, we have Petter Renforth, George Karikos, Mason Cole, Imran Ahmed Shah, Philip Corwin, Matt Cohen is on audio, David Maher is on audio, Osvaldo Mazzola. Oh, David Maher just joined. We have no apologies at this time. From staff, I have Dennis Chang, Steve Chan, Barry Cobb, and myself, Julie Bisland. I'd like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes, and please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid background noise. And with this, I'll turn it over to Petter Renforth.
Thank you. Petter here. So let's start, as usual, with the question if there is any new statement of interest. And as usual, new hands up. So we go directly on the point two of the agenda, which is to proceed where we started last week. And I'll just make, yes, Phil.
Yeah, thanks, Petter. Sorry to interrupt, but the proposed agenda, items two and three are reversed from the proposed agenda that Steve sent out last night. I think it might be more useful to start with three to update those on the call of what we've been doing for outreach and kind of what our process is going forward so that everybody understands the following discussion of the options paper in the context of a very tight schedule where we all have only two more calls after this one before the working group meeting in Abu Dhabi. So I hope you can take that suggestion under advisement, again noting that the agenda, that order has been switched since the email was sent out last night. Thank you.
Thanks, Phil. And as staff just before you joined noted that Mary is the one that has all the updates, and she will arrive a little bit later to the meeting. So I think it was like 15 minutes or so. That's why it has changed on the agenda.
Okay. Well, then let me just follow up briefly, just so if
yeah,
I can...
Yeah, sorry, Didra, if you have any specific information or want to discuss Mary's inputs, that's okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll be very brief, just so participants on the call understand the general process going forward. I believe our objective today is to reach near final agreement on this options paper. When Mary gets on, we'll describe the outreach efforts we've undertaken over the last week, but we expect by tomorrow to have a final curated list of the still active members of this working group. We're considering the possibility of a webinar on where the final report stands, all of the provisions, and a final discussion of the options on the remaining question next week, and then to put out a consensus call by email and report back on those results on the call of the 19th so that we can go to Abu Dhabi and have a session where we can present the outlines of all the key points of the final report and take feedback in Abu Dhabi and then come back after Abu Dhabi and move toward a consensus call on a final report, which everyone will have an opportunity to suggest edits to it. So I think that's correct. If you have any corrections or anything to add to that, but I just thought it'd be good so people understand the context for this call and what our plans are for the next two calls and then going to Abu Dhabi. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, Phil, for that. Sorry. The only thing I may add to that is that when we had our call this Monday to discuss, for instance, this seminar for that is focused on the members that have not participated but still want to be updated. There was also a request from, was it both from the council and the board to have the opportunity to participate and get updates on that call? I don't remember correctly.
Yeah, Petter, fill again. Yeah, that's correct, and you're correct on that. We had considered also inviting, if they're interested, people from outside the working group to attend that session to get an update. But the primary purpose would be to make sure that all working group members are familiar with the entitle and, you know, where our final report stands, and then we can take a consensus call on that and hopefully get the results back for the 19th. Thank you.
Thanks. So, and of course, that call seminar could also be good for all of us to also those active members to have an update and hopefully also to get some new input and comments and clarifications from members that have noted that they still want to be members of a working group, but for some reasons didn't have the possibility to participate in our meetings but actively. Okay. I'll just check out the chat room if there is anything to... I think that what George has stated are more of the general topic, but I will reach out to you in a minute. As you can see from the documentation here, we have already gone through the preliminary notes, and there is no amendments made there. We finalized the discussion about option A last week, but here you can see just a minor amendment in the text that I believe is based on what we discussed there. So we're losing Redisent challenges the initial UDRP URS decision by filing suit in the National Court of Mutual Jurisdiction. And IGO that succeeded in its initial UDRP URS complaint also succeeds in asserting jurisdictional immunity. That's taken away a claim of. So that's the only change there. And in option B, there are a little bit more changes, but I presume that George want to proceed with the comments that we when we had to finalize our meeting last week, and we were in the middle of the discussion of option B. So do you have any further comments, information, what do you think about option B there? George?
George Krikos for the transcript. Yeah, those changes look fine. On the right-hand side, there's comments on when the applicable date would be. That's probably an implementation detail, but I would be in favor of it being, you know, the policy effective date, the third option on that list, because you don't want to kind of be backdating the rules and how when they become effective, you'd want to let potential registrants know that the new rules are in effect as of the date that the policy is finalized. Thank you.
Okay, good. So then I'll try to read it here as it should be in relation to main names with a creation date. There's a note there. Let's see what creation date is a field containing the WHOIS response format. It is the understanding of this working group that for this specific field, the creation date value would not change as a result of change of resistance, including from drop catching scenarios. So also so that I have it clear from last week what's meant here in option B with the creation date is that the first date of the registration of the domain name. And as long as it's a main name that are still in life, but it's not deregistered for some time, even if it's ours. But if it's just transferred directly to a new holder, it keeps the creation date. So it's the creation, not the registration date of the current holder, but the creation date of the domain name as such. And having in mind that a domain name lives as long as it's still registered. So if someone don't renew it and it comes out in the free air, so to speak, again, then it's and registered, and same domain name is registered again, then it comes a new creation date for that. Okay, then option A applies in relation to domain names with a creation date on or after. And there we have this clarification that the date should be, that date should be the date of when this new regulation is in force. Option C shall apply after 5 years or 10 instances of option C being utilized, whichever occurs first, ICANN and the various dispute resolution providers, including any who have administered arbitration proceedings under the new option C, will conduct a reviewing to determine the impact, both positive and negative, as a result of trying out option C. So that's the new text of option B. And then we come to option C. See that Phil says I'm fine with the proposed edits on pages 1 and 2 prior to the heading General Principles for Binding Arbitration. Okay. Good. So, option C, where a complainant IGO succeeds in a UDRP URS proceeding, the losing registrant proceeds to file a suit in a court of mutual jurisdiction, and IGO subsequently succeeds in asserting jurisdictional immunity, the registrant shall have the option to transfer the dispute to an arbitration forum meeting certain pre-established criteria. And we have listed them a little bit further. For determination under a national law that the original appeal was based upon, which such action limited to deciding the ownership of the domain name. An IGO who files a complaint under the UDRP URS shall be required to agree to this limited arbitration mechanism when filing the complaint. The parties shall have the option to mutually agree to limit the original judicial proceedings to solely determining the ownership of the domain name. Subject to agreement by the registrant concerned, the parties shall also be free to utilize the limited arbitration mechanism described above at any time prior to the registrant filing suit in a court of mutual jurisdiction. And there's a new line here: in agreeing to utilize the limited arbitration mechanism, both the complainant and respondent are required to inform ICANN. And what we have added here from last week was the what we have discussed previously, some general principles for binding arbitration. And if you remember, we talked about also last week that it could well be that there are maybe some details to decide upon, whatever of these options we propose, and that there could be a new working group dealing with that. But that's why I wanted to remind us about that we actually have discussed some general principles, which is could be more of guidance for how this binding arbitration shall be done. So the first point here, substantive law, arbitrator decides dispute under the national law under which the judicial appeal was originally brought. Not the UDRP, both parties can mutually agree to proceed under another national law. This is the normal practice in arbitration cases. So this text, I see, is not perhaps finally, formally written, but this is something for us to further discuss. And the procedure rules, same as in the applicable judicial system, different rules can be mutually agreed to by both parties. And again, this is also to get it similar to the UDRP as it is today, where in fact, if both parties agrees about it, there could be both when it comes to the language of the dispute and when it comes to which court to appeal, but otherwise there are specifications in the regulations on where to appeal, so to speak. The venue to be conducted in an arbitration forum certified to meet certain basic criteria, and those basic criteria we can either further discuss or leave to the group that then will put this order in practice, and cannot be an IGO, just to have it 100% neutral, or the arbitration forum that decided the underlying UDRP to assure lack of bias and de novo review. And I would say that even if the risk that for instance, WIPO or the underlying UDRP would be not be neutral in this phase. We need to make sure that there is not even a risk or a gray zone for any parties to think that there could be. That there is not perfect neutrality in this part. Panelists, default option is a three-member panel, and the chair of which must be a retired judge from that jurisdiction. Explore possibility of creating a standing panel from which to choose the two panelists other than the chair. That means the parties cannot choose the chair on the panel. And that is the same as in a three-panel UDRP. I mean, the parties, if they want to have a three-panel, they can choose from a list or they can propose one panel on their own, and the other party will have a list with their suggestions in the panels, but the chair should be definitely completely neutral. Language, the same language to be used as in national jurisdictional forum. Alternative language can be selected by mutual agreement of the parties. And again, I think that's important to have as similar as such from the original UDRP, so that the parties can understand, and also if they have in that dispute decided on a specific language, it's good to, and it's probably also safe for both parties to proceed with that language that all have decided upon. Discovery, same as in judicial case. And then we have the interim remedies, the same as if court case had continued. I think there's an example there with domain locking. I see that, in fact, as the only possible interim remedy in a case like this. And it's also very similar to the URS proceeding. Remedies, same as in judicial case. Cost seeks to be the same as or lower than in a judicial case. And although when it comes to the cost here, I presume that that will be a question that ICANN and board will have to decide upon in the final phase. To avoid that the costs are extending, but at least the same as in a normal judicial case. Enforcement of award, decision to uphold UDRP determination would result in the main transfer or extinguishment. Enforcement of any available monetary award against IGO needs to be considered, but at a minimum, failure to pay could bar it from any future ability to file a UDRP or URS. And then we have the presidential value of decision. Whilst there's no way to fully replicate the precedent of a court decision, policy could state a distinct recommendation that any case shifted to arbitration should consider and seek to follow judicial precedent on similar cases brought under the same law, and also be consistent with prior arbitrations under that law, if there are any similar that exists. So, that is option C, which is also the option that, and now I speak personally here, on the option that have the best chances to be efficient and to be accepted by all parties that are involved. And as said before, there are, in these cases, rarely any options that can be 100% accepted by everyone and are perfect. But we need to find a solution that is in response to the work we have been cited to do, and also to be accepted by the council and GAC and ICANN board, and as I said, also the other parties involved. So, George.
George Kirkus for the transcript. I raised this point at the end of last week's call briefly, talking about how there are some interesting matches in Google if you do search for court-appointed arbitrator or court-appointed arbitration, et cetera. And I posted a link in the chat room, which is from the Justice Department of the Government of Canada, talking about dispute resolution and arbitration, and how parties can go to the courts to help clarify, you know, who the arbitrators would be or the venue, et cetera. Because one of the issues I have with the proposal is that conceivably you could have panelists who are outside that country's jurisdiction. Like, let's say I'm a Canadian registrant. I want to have the dispute handled under Canadian law. I would want to have panelists who are familiar with the Canadian law. And so I wouldn't want to have panelists, say, from China or Iran or South America who have no familiarity with the Canadian judicial system, even though there's, you know, a retired judge as the from that jurisdiction as the chair. I don't think it would be very helpful to have the two other panelists not be familiar with that jurisdiction's laws. And so the article I linked to showed how perhaps the court could be involved, because Phil had pointed out that the court might not want any involvement because the immunity claim was successful. However, that being said, the arbitration clause would then be binding unless the IGOs make the claim that the arbitration clause is not binding, which I guess conceivably they could make if you follow that logic. But assuming that the arbitration clause is binding, and we do know that IGOs have agreed to arbitration in the past, then one could just leave the procedure, some of the specifics of the procedure, to be approved by the court. Thank you.
Thanks, George. Phil?
Thanks, Peter. Phil, for the record, I want to say kind of three different categories of things here. First, our goal, hopefully, today is to agree on final language of this options paper that where members of the working group agree that it gives a reasonably accurate description of the three options on which we'll be taking a consensus call. And again, I just want to remind members that the job of this working group is to give broad policy recommendations with detail, but not to the level of detail of an implementation review team would get into if any or all of these recommendations are ultimately approved by council and the board and need to be implemented. So we want to give sufficient guidance so that an IRT would understand what the policy group recommended and not go off on their own and negate or change those recommendations, but we don't need to get down too far into the weeds on that. Second, in regard to George's suggestion, I think it's worth listing. My concern is that in some cases, once the judge says, okay, IGO, you're not properly before this court, you have immunity under our national laws and under the facts you presented to us, I'm not sure we can rely on that judge to do anything other than terminate the case at that point, and many judges might not be willing to appoint arbitrators. So I think we need at least a backup if it's the view of the working group that should be a primary goal. I have no opinion one way or the other whether that's a good idea to let the judge appoint the panelists. I also think we have to look at whether what would happen if an arbitration body selected by the panelists has one group of panelists they use, and the judge appoints panelists who are not affiliated with that arbitration body. That's another complication. So far as the IGO attacking the arbitration clause or refusing to consent to the arbitration and appear at the arbitration, I believe we had agreed, at least on the last call, that we're going to make clear in the final report that if the registrant will have a reasonable period of time to decide to go to arbitration if the judicial action is dismissed, and that should probably be added to the details of option C, and make clear that if the IGO refuses to participate in the arbitration, the effect of that is to permanently stay enforcement of the underlying UDRP decision, that the IGO cannot get the UDRP result effectuated by boycotting the arbitration. So that's another detail that should be added here. Finally, in reviewing the language under general principles for binding arbitration, which is language where I was the original drafter, but it was quite some time ago at an earlier stage of our deliberations, 2-3 months ago, I do note that there are two places, one where I think we should consider it, whether we want to keep it, and one where I think we have to make a change. The first is under substantive law, and the language there is arbitrator decides dispute under the national law, which the judicial appeal, under which the judicial appeal was originally brought, not the UDRP, and then / both parties can mutually agree to proceed under another national law. This is, and then in parentheses, this is a normal practice in arbitration cases. I'm not necessarily opposed to that, and I believe Petter added this, the second part of that about mutual agreement on under another law. I would only note that this might, we've got a situation where the ability in the first place to bring a judicial appeal is not available to all registrants. It's only available to registrants who have some ties, either through their residence or the registrar they've used, to a nation which has a law like the USACPA, which provides for separate adjudication of domain name trademark disputes. So I'm just wondering whether it's appropriate, since that's a precondition for bringing the underlying judicial appeal, to then let the parties choose a different law. But I'll leave that open for discussion. The one place where I think we need to edit this to be accurate is noting that in option C, subject to further discussions we've had, it says that, and this is in regard to the arbitration, that it says such action limited, it says with such action limited to deciding the ownership of the domain name. So we've narrowed down the scope of the arbitration to disposition of the domain name, and not other remedies that might be available under national law for various reasons, including questionable ability of the arbitration forum to enforce such other provisions. So down in the description under enforcement of award, it says decision to uphold IUDRP determination would result in domain transfer or extinguishment. And then there's a semicolon based on the description now contained for option C. The remainder of this language regarding enforcement of available monetary awards seems to be superfluous, no longer relevant. And if we're going to stick with the narrowing of the scope of the arbitration contained in option C, then that language after the semicolon should be deleted. That's all I had on the on this right now. And and one other typographical in option C, in the paragraph, in the sentence on the fifth line, that says an IGO who files a complaint, it should be an IGO which files a complaint, because an IGO is not a natural person; it's an organization. So who should be changed to which? That's all the comments I had. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Phil. And Petter here again. Just a note that to what George said, I think it's meant to be clarified also under the penalty point. Where it's it says that at least the chair must be a retired judge from that jurisdiction, and that jurisdiction means referring to the point of substantive law. I think those two points, substantive law and the panelists, at least tries to to explain that the chair judge must have knowledge about the legislation that the dispute is related to. And again, I think that it could be good and fair to both parties if they have the if they have the agreement to use another national law. But again, said that it must be both parties, both the domain holder and the complainant. And in that case, of course, panelist referring again to the first point there would be the chair would be someone that are very familiar with and hopefully come from the specific jurisdiction related to that national law. And if we have these points clearly stated in the general principles, I don't think we need to have some additions turning to the judge in the court to decide upon that. If it's clearly stated which jurisdiction, which national law that is to be used for this binding arbitration, it would be enough, I think. So maybe we need to make a little bit clarification on that when it comes to the definition of the panelists, and perhaps also on the substantive law. Okay, I saw that Mary, welcome. You have joined us now, so I let you squeeze in here. Sorry for that expression, and update us on the outreach to working group members before we proceed.
Hi, everyone, and thank you, Petter. This is Mary, and apologies again for being detained by another call. In terms of outreach to all the members of the working group, as noted and as instructed by the co-chairs, we not only sent emails to everyone who has not been attending the calls asking if they wish to remain members and asking if there's anything we could do to bring them up to speed if they have not been following as closely because of other commitments. We did receive, as we reported last time, some responses. Some people said, yes, I'd like to remain part of the group. Yes, I intend to participate in the consensus call. A couple of people said, no, I don't wish to continue as a member, and so their status has been changed to that of observer. If you go to the membership page right now, and this was updated, I believe, 2 days ago by staff, you'll see that we have updated the numbers according to the responses we received, and at the moment we are listing 26 members. We are still outstanding despite the reminders, responses from, I believe, about 6 individuals or so. So we can follow up with those folks, but we are remaining about 6, maybe 7 non-responsive folks. The rest have either confirmed or asked to be removed. Petter?
Thank you, Mary. And as was said, we plan to have an informative session to those members. Phil?
Yes, Peter. I wanted to thank Mary for that update. That's good news. So it appears that we have at least 20 members and possibly up to 26. I think we ought to agree on this call what the deadline is for the remaining six who haven't indicated a preference to get back. I would suggest, you know, a few more days, but before our next call on the 12th, you know, maybe set a deadline of the 10th or 11th so that we have a firm number of members. But I'm encouraged that we, I think, have a good enough list of members that we're fairly well insulated against any allegations that might be made that we have too few and or insufficient representation of various elements of the ICANN community. Thanks,
Phil. And I also note that, sorry, I'll turn over to you in a second, Mary. Just see George note here that once a decision is no longer appealable under the time limits of the various countries, then the clock starts ticking on the arbitration options. And thanks for that. I think it's important to put that in as we cannot write a specific time in days here. As George said, when we go to court, it could be a quick or a solution or decision that takes a very long time before the court make any decision, even if it's the initial one, if they can take the case or not. So then we have to put in some more neutral language to clarify that. I would take George's words there as something to add and to start with in that aspect. Yes, Mary.
Thanks, Peter and Phil. I just had one last follow-up on the outreach question, and then, if I may, I did have a question regarding George's suggestion. So let me just complete the outreach item. So our understanding is that we will reach out one more time to those few individuals that haven't responded, and we had asked them to respond to us, if possible, by today, but we will reach out one more time and give a deadline of a specific date next week. But in addition to that, if you look at the list of members, you'll see that even without the individuals that haven't responded, we do have representation. In some cases, perhaps just one member, but you see representation from across the GNSO and with a couple of individuals and representatives or legal representatives of non-governmental organizations. So just to give you a spread of the membership as we have it today. I'll stop here, Peter, and hold my question because I see that George has raised his hand.
Thanks, Mary. And that's also something I noted when we looked through the list of members and the list of active members. There may not be so many, but we have a good spread out about the interests and that the active members represents. Okay, George.
George Kriegos for the transcript. Yeah, I just want to talk a little bit about that representation aspect. I'm not sure what the rules are, say, on representation, but it seems to me that on the various PDPs that some topics or issues will affect some stakeholders more than others. For example, this particular topic would most affect registrants and IGOs. And in this case, at least the registrants are well represented, and the IGOs have had, you know, many opportunities to have their views represented. And we've also had some of the trademark people at least represent themselves in comments and occasionally on this PDP as well. Some of the other GNSO constituencies might not be as directly affected by the topic, so if their representation didn't exist, it doesn't necessarily mean that it should affect the outcome of the PDP. So I just wanted to raise that as a comment. Thank you.
Thank you, George. I'm glad to see Mary's hands up again, because I also had a question to you based on that. If it's possible to see it from that practical view that some topics are specific interesting for some of our ICANN members and groups of interest, and that's why you don't see so many participants from other groups. Mary.
Thanks, Peter, and thanks, George. So kind of starting with Peter's comment, it is true, and I think this is something that's recognized within the ICANN community, that certain issues, even if it is a complex or simple PDP, would be of more interest to certain parts of the community than others, just by the nature of the topic. And I believe this is actually specifically recognized in the GNSO's working group guidelines. So when we speak of representativeness and inclusiveness, it is with that backdrop in mind. In relation to membership and representation, going to George's initial question, typically, and as a general rule, everyone who participates in a PDP participates as an individual. It is also possible that a person participates on behalf of a group, and that group could be one of the GNSO stakeholder groups or any of the other ICANN supporting organizations or advisory committees. For example, we've seen in some PDPs participants from the at-large community or the at-large advisory committee, and we've also seen in some of our groups that some GNSO participants, even though they are members of a particular constituency or stakeholder group, they may be participating in that PDP as an individual. Conversely, for another PDP, they or some other member of that group could be representing that stakeholder group or that constituency. Same with, you know, trade associations, lawyers representing their clients, and so forth. So there aren't any restrictions as such. There aren't any rules as such. One of the things that we did create, as I think everyone on this call knows, is observer status, so that for individuals or representatives who are not able for any reason to participate actively, they can still follow the mailing list. And of course, regardless of whether anyone is a member or an observer, all the calls are recorded and transcribed, all the documents are published, so there's every possibility of anyone who isn't, if he signed up as a member observer, of really still following along all the discussions that take place. So that's really kind of the mechanics of how the multi-stakeholder model within a GNSO PDP works writ large. And I hope that's helpful.
Thanks, Mary. And I would say that when it comes to ideas that this topic is actually for them. Even if we don't have any active members in the working group, we had three of them twice making presentations and participating in the discussions on our working group meetings, and they have also made comments on our proposals and more from time to time informal contacts. So they have participated in the way they have chosen to participate. Mary.
Thanks, Peter. I forgot to add that you know, the working group guidelines and the GNSO's procedures do explicitly do two things. One is require a PDP working group to seek input from the other community groups, and this is something that this group did early on, and the requirement is to do it early on. But secondly, there is also the possibility for a group at any time to solicit further input, whether directly and specifically or through public comments. So that's also another way in which input can be received. Thanks, Petter.
Thanks. Phil, I see your hands up.
Thank you, Petter. Phil, for the record, two quick things. On the final working group membership, looking at that list and noting that six may still be in doubt, but, I'm comfortable that, if we have 26, it's more than two dozen members. If it winds up only being 20, that's still reasonable numbers for a standard ICANN working group, and there's members from all the parts of the commercial stakeholder group other than the ISPs, from the non-commercial. We've got registries, registrars. We've got people in their individual capacity. So I think it's I'm quite comfortable it can withstand any criticism of not being representative of the community, and we've had a completely open process. And as noted, while the IGOs chose to be only observers, not members, they've had multiple opportunities to provide direct input to our working group. Returning to the other issue of fleshing out the final details of option C, I think we should settle on the or try to settle today on the time in which a registrant, if there is a judicial decision recognizing the immunity defense, how long that registrant has to invoke the arbitration option, or, as George ably pointed out, to undertake a judicial appeal if they believe that the lower court erred in finding valid immunity. And looking at the UDRP itself, I note that Section 4K of the UDRP gives the domain registrant, if there's an adverse UDRP decision, it gives the registrant 10 business days to notify the panel that it's invoking its right to seek judicial review, which would in turn stay enforcement of the decision. So that's one possibility. That would be one that's based right on the current language of the UDRP, 10 business days after the court decision. Whatever we decide on that, thinking about this, I think we should also recognize that bringing an appeal on an issue of law is somewhat more complex sometimes, and the law of the jurisdiction may in fact give a period that's longer than 10 business days or whatever period we decide is appropriate for that decision. So I think, if we use the 10 business days, I think the UDRP decision should be continued to be stayed unless the applicant advises the UDRP provider within 10 days of the court decision that either it's seeking arbitration or, in the alternative, that it intends to bring an appeal on an issue of law, but that if it can cite a national statute or procedures, which gives it a longer period to file that appeal, I think we should give it that longer period. If a jurisdiction gives someone, let's say, 30 days, an example, to file an appeal on an issue of law to question an underlying court decision, we should recognize that and not hold the applicant to a shorter period, particularly since those type of appeals may take some time to research and before a final decision can be made. So I just wanted to speak to that in our attempt to flesh out the final details of these options on today's call. Thank you.
Thanks, Phil. And so then we'll have within 10 business days to go to arbitration, or otherwise if another party wants to appeal the first court decision, it depends on the normal time for appeal legislation in that country. And I have to say that I haven't thought about appealing the court decision that way. But of course, that means that the final decision may take years. And it's up to the parties, of course. I think also, talking about the timeline, it's good if we have suggested to put in that the parties can agree on a very early stage to skip the court action and go directly to arbitration. And that's something that I think could be well worked for the domain holder, but it's also something that one of the few conclusions that at least I could take from the very general expressions and comments from IGOs, that they like to see the possibility to go directly to an arbitration after the UDRP. Okay, good. I see George comments here. So, any further comments and thoughts? Phil?
Yes, Peter, thank you. Phil, for the record, just comment on your observation that an appeal on an issue of law could take an extended period of time. I recognize that, but, we've taken a pretty firm position throughout our work that we're not going to have ICANN foreclosing legal options for either party. And noting that if a judicial appeal was brought and the court decided that under the applicable national law that there was no trademark infringement, that the IGO would be free to appeal that decision if they thought there was an error of law, the way the appeals process works in most jurisdictions. So it's an even-handed suggestion to, I don't know how many registrants would want to appeal an immunity determination, but some might, and we shouldn't be foreclosing their legal rights, and IGOs would have the same legal rights to appeal a determination that no infringement had taken place. Thank you.
Thanks, Phil. Yes, I agree with you. I just made my personal comment on that if any of the parties appeal, the process will take a very long time until they have a final decision. But as you say, it's not up to us to decide upon how they should proceed that way. And also, again, talking about the time limits when the parties, if they choose to appeal instead of go to arbitration, I also agree that it would be strange if we had specific rules with definitely more limited time for that when it comes to domain name disputes than
are actually the practice in that specific country, which could well be 30 days and perhaps even could be extra time if any of the parties wants that. So, in short, we have to accept each national law when it comes to that point. Matt.
I think I actually had my question answered by rereading option C, which was that by mutual agreement, both parties could go directly to arbitration and avoid the back and forth in the going to court. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Yeah, I think it seems likely that rather than spend a lot of resources on a big court battle, that it might be in the interest of both parties just to go directly to arbitration. And I see that that's already accounted for here. So I will take down my hand.
Yeah, good. Yeah, hopefully. I mean, we're still talking about very rare amount of cases, but I presume that in most of those, the parties will use that possibility to skip all the time-consuming process of having the case to a court and then to a court of appeal. George.
George Gregos for the transcript. I did want to add that it could be that the IGO is the one that's appealing the immunity issue. For example, they might the initial court might rule that the IGO doesn't have immunity and that the court case could proceed, and then the IGO could appeal to a higher court just on that issue alone before the merits of the actual action are considered by the lower court, whether or not they do have immunity. So, and that can happen multiple times. For example, in Ontario, usually there's a lower court, and there's, an Ontario Court of Appeal, and then conceivably the Supreme Court of Canada. And we've seen some of these IGOs take the cases to the Supreme Court of Canada. And I assume that there's probably three levels of courts in most other large developed countries as well. And as for the time aspects, I think what will happen is that we would only ever see this option in the cases of it being a very valuable domain name, so say a two-letter domain name, a three-letter domain name, or a single dictionary word domain name, or where there's very high principles at stake. For example, let's say WIPO wanted to go after WIPO.com if the domain name owner is well off financially, they might want to spend all the resources to defend their rights to free speech, etc. So perhaps don't have any burning house or any emergency aspect to them where it needs to be necessarily resolved in a quick time manner. And that's actually one of the impetuses behind option B, because for all these domain names that have already been registered, IGOs have had 20 plus years to go after the domain names. Why should they now be subject to a new mechanism that might expose them to risk? Thank you.
Thank you, George. Okay. So, good. I see from the notes that we have got some points from today to add and rephrase. And once that is done, we will have our three options with that are now finally specified to send out, if I remember correct, send out the full working group for comments and votes. For the possibility to make a decision in the nearest weeks. And then I think we have actually done with the topics of today. George.
George, just again for the transcript, if we're on the all other business, I wanted to raise a point that I had actually posted at the top of the chat room early on about an article in Domain Name Wire that talked about domain name seizures, and that might be something that we could incorporate into our final report because it talks about how law enforcement can quickly take down allegedly illegal domain names that are, in this case, it was in the pharmaceutical industry. We have allegedly fake pharmacies or illegal pharmacies. And similar procedures could be used by the IGOs. The EDRP and the URS aren't the be-all and end-all in terms of their available procedures to combat cyber squatting and so on. And I noticed that in the first page of the document, the words under these mechanisms were added in the second last paragraph, and that kind of falls into that same topic. Thank you.
Thank you, George. I think we have talked about for a time, long time ago, once we finalize our suggestions and comments, to have some note that there are also other alternatives for IGOs, at least to have a note somewhere. Phil.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. Two things as we move toward completion of this call. The first, I have no problems within our final report referencing other possible ways that IGOs might seek to address alleged trademark infringement. I think on domain seizures, we want to be careful to just note that this has been done without endorsing it, because that practice is undertaken by some national authorities, particularly in regard to allegations of copyright infringement, has been somewhat controversial within various sectors of the Internet community. So I think we just want to be on the side of noting the possibility without endorsing any particular alternative action. Turning to next steps, I just want to state my understanding of how we're going forward and make sure others share the same understanding, that following today's discussion, staff will circulate an updated version of this options paper, which incorporates all the changes that were just in here in redline form, and also add some of the additional detail that came out of our discussion today, and that we'll circulate that to working group members, and hopefully by email can ascertain that everyone's agreed that that's a reasonably accurate description of the options for consensus call purposes, recognizing that nothing's final until we go to looking at a draft of a final report, which will be post Abu Dhabi, and that when we take the consensus call of members, we're going to be asking for, on each of the elements of the final report, an indication of support, opposition, or neutrality, and particularly in regard to options A, B, and C, we need to determine under the GNSO methods not just support but opposition, so that an option that gets 12, let's say there's 20 members, a option that gets 12 votes of support and no opposition is in a quite different situation than one that gets 12 votes of support and 8 votes of opposition. It's a different description of the general tenor of the working group's disposition. So, we'll work with staff and we'll put out those details before the consensus call, but that's my understanding of how we're going forward. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Phil. So at least by our meeting next week, we will have the final amended script that we have discussed today and last week. Mary.
Thanks, Phil, and thanks, Peter, for outlining the steps clearly. The staff just had a question, and maybe there's more a question for Peter or Phil and Phil, but it's also a question for planning for the next couple of weeks before the Abu Dhabi session. You'll remember that a few members had indicated that they thought a webinar to bring everyone up to speed might be helpful. So we're just wondering if we should try to schedule that, if not for next Thursday, the 12th, then the Thursday following, which would be the Thursday before folks start to travel to Abu Dhabi.
Mary, thanks for reminding me about that. And I think that if we should have that webinar, it must, and now I think loud out, but I think the only time we have for that would be to combine with on next week's working group, because if a webinar hopefully can activate some of our members that are still interested in the topic but haven't been on our meeting, it must be fairly soon from now on, so that they can also come in with their comments on our proposed final report. I don't know what Phil think about that timeline.
I just typed in the chat. I agree. We should aim to have that on October 12th. The purpose of the main purpose of the webinar is to make sure that all members have an opportunity to participate and be fully informed on and be able to ask questions about anything they're being asked to show consensus disposition on before doing so. Doing it after the vote, not really the vote, but the determination of disposition of the working group members wouldn't make sense. We want to do it before, and the secondary purpose is to bring other interested members of the community up to speed on where we are before we get to Abu Dhabi.
Thanks. So let's proceed that way. George, do you have any comments on this?
Related, back in September, Jonathan Pissarro, and I just put a link into the chat room, had inquired about possibly going to the Abu Dhabi meeting, and I don't know if there was any update on that, perhaps off that separate mailing list. And he also might want to be reminded that even if he doesn't get travel funding to Abu Dhabi, he could obviously participate via remote participation through Adobe Chat. If we have a webinar or even during the Abu Dhabi meeting, there's always the remote participation available to him. I don't think that was mentioned to him on that mailing list. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Good point. Mary?
Yeah, I just want to thank Georgia for that reminder, and we will certainly be sending out remote participation details. And what we can do on the staff side is to send the details as well as the, again, the time and date of our session to that mailing list as well, which I think, George, if you're referring to the discussion group for the reconciling the Red Cross and IGO protections issues. And just to note that staff has not heard further from John or anyone else. I don't know whether he will be getting travel funding from OECD, but if he does, one will hope that he and other interested IGOs will be able to attend our session in Abu Dhabi. And if he does not travel to Abu Dhabi, and interested IGOs, including the OECD, can, as George said, participate remotely. Thanks very much.
Thanks. Yes, and then he was obviously interested in the topic and to see how far we had come. So at least he could participate online. Phil?
Yes, thank you. Just quickly adding, as working group members know, both Peter and I have been involved in that separate discussion group chaired by Bruce Tonkin. Frankly, that discussion group activity has fallen way off since the in the last few months, and we've heard nothing further in response to Jonathan's question. So as far as we know, there are no plans for convening that informal group in Abu Dhabi. If we get advised that there is going to be such a meeting, we'll certainly try to attend unless we're physically unable to. And noting, of course, that our working group meeting in Abu Dhabi will be an excellent way for any interested party to know the likely components of our final report and provide final input, and that ICANN, for those who are unable or unwilling to travel to Abu Dhabi, that ICANN's remote participation technology is very good and affords people not on the scene physically full opportunity to participate. Thank you.
Thanks. That actually, let me phrase a question here. Could be interesting to see how many of you that participate today will also have the possibility to be physically on the spot in Abu Dhabi. So if those that will attend physically can just click on the agree button. Okay, I see me and George, Phil, I mean, okay. But I hope that the rest of you can participate online so that we can have a further inputs and comments and come a bit further to our final conclusion. Good. Okay. Then I think we are finalized for today. If no one wants to spend some more minutes on any of the topics we have discussed, I see no hands up. Excellent. So we will likely have the informative webinar by next meeting, next week. And hopefully then also we'll see some more of our previously active members to participate in that. And also thereafter give comments on our proposals. George.
George Ricos, just a small point. I know the ICANN staff is very pressed, especially before these ICANN meetings, but if it's possible to get any document a couple of days before the next meeting, that would be great, because I've noticed, at least in the PDPs that I'm participating in, that sometimes the documents are coming the day before, or sometimes the same day as the meeting, so it's very hard to catch up on the reading. It kind of forces one to do it immediately instead of having a few days to incorporate it into one schedule, if that's possible. Thanks.
Mary, what do you think about that? No, we'll do
hi,
you. yes, I see
your comment. I typed in AC chat, but thanks, George, and we will do our best. And I do know what you mean, that there are times when documents may not come in at an optimal time for folks or very close to a call, but we will definitely try our best, especially in relation to this group as you move towards consensus. Thanks.
Thanks, Mary. And I know that you're all doing an enormous and excellent work, not just for our working group, but of course also if we are going to have the webinar next week, it would definitely be good to have all the updated information as early as possible. Then I haven't said any number of
hours or days, but this time. So, thanks, and see you next week. Thanks for today.
Bye, all.
Thank you, Peter, Phil, everyone. Goodbye.
Thanks for joining, everyone. Jeff, can you please stop the recording? And everyone have a great rest of the day.